Hey folks, Jared here. Several notes for you to start. First is the logo. We finally have a new logo. It's getting a few final tweaks, but you should see it up here in the next 2 weeks. Spoiler alert, I love it, but I am putting together a post to explain it. So that's the primary delay right now. The second is podcast frequency. So we've been pumping out 2 episodes per week for a while now, and the response to that has been very enthusiastic. We are going to slow down a bit. One, due to the imminent arrival of a new member of my household. So you'll still get 1 episode per week airing Saturday evenings. And once I have adapted to my new schedule with the family, we'll see if we can't increase the frequency again. But it'll be probably 1 to 2 months where we slow down and just go 1 episode per week. Next, I've talked about our feed. I'm going to keep bringing it up, but there are 2 existing C-Control feeds out there. The current one is labeled simply C-Control and includes the phrase Simsex Flagship Podcast in its description. Once the new logo is up, it ought to be much easier to figure out which is the correct feed. In the meantime, C-Control, Simsex Flagship Podcast, that's where you want to be. Please rate and review the new feed as well. Today we have John Frericks hosting. He's joined by Ryan Hilger, and they'll be discussing Service Squadron 10 and past, present, and future concepts in mobile basing. This episode was produced and edited by William McQuiston. Don't miss everything going on over at the main website, simsec.org. Final call for articles for Project Trident is live. We're partnering with Lockheed Martin and Naval Warfare Studies Institute at the Naval Postgraduate School for Emerging Technologies. We've also partnered with Transcom for a series of articles on strategic sea lift. Those articles have been great thus far, and frequent listeners ought to recognize a lot of the bylines. Finally, I want to take the opportunity to recommend our partners in the SimSec podcast network, the Bilge Pumps. You can find Alex, Jamie, Drac, and a pile of Iron Brew bottles wherever you download your podcasts. And on that note, I'll turn it over to Kimber Smith.
You're listening to Sea Control, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security.
Guten Tag, shipmates, and welcome back. Today, we will discuss a recent article published by the Center for International Maritime Security called Service Squadron 10 and the Great Western Base. Today, we are fortunate to be joined by the author of the article, Lieutenant Commander Ryan Hilger. The article was published by SimSec in April of 2021 and will be linked in the show notes on the SimSec website. The historical context of HAL Service Support Squadron 10 was essential to the success of the Pacific campaign, combined with a forward-looking proposal and the challenge to the Naval Service, makes this article a must-read for anyone with interest in maritime security. I was personally excited to read the article as it addresses a topic that is often neglected and I've talked about before, logistics. Before we begin, I'll remind the listeners that all opinions expressed are our own and not reflective of any institutions with which we might otherwise be associated. Ryan, welcome. And in addition to a personal introduction, I'd ask you to tell us, why did you decide to write about Service Squadron 10?
Thanks for having me, John. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on to Sea Control, one of the best podcasts that's out there on maritime security. By way of a little bit of a background, I'm career naval officer so far. I spent the first 10 years of my career in the submarine force doing 2 tours. I've spent time in the Pentagon with the CNO's Chief of Naval Operations Strategic Studies Group, and now as an engineering duty officer working acquisition programs for the military. I've enjoyed over the past decade or so writing at the intersection of technology, leadership, innovation, and strategy or great power composition. The interwar period in particular, which Service Squadron 10 has its roots in, interests me greatly just because there's so many lessons that can come out of it. And it's, as I was looking at different topics to write about last year, I was looking at the interwar period and treaty cruisers struck me, and SimSec published one of my articles about treaty cruisers last October. And then Service Squadron 10 was also there. As I dug into the logistics of it more, it was like, holy smokes. It never really dawned on me, and probably not on most people as well, that the Navy spent almost 3 years physically at sea and never returned to Pearl after about late 1943. And I wanted to explore how they made that happen, what happened, and how they made it work. Because I think it's incredibly relevant for today and trying to access that same region of the world again, should great power competition demand that of us.
That's great. And I'd like to explore a little bit further. So why did you find it important to provide the historical context of Service Squadron 10 by just jumping into recommendations for the future? And was there anything unique or interesting that you uncovered during the course of your research that did not make it into the article?
Oh, there was so much. This article could have been so much longer. There's an entire book out there written by Rear Admiral or retired Admiral Carter, who commanded service force in World War II. He wrote the book in the 1950s called Bullets, Beans, and Black Oil. And there's an enormous wealth of data that's there. But as far as the historical context, I'm a huge believer in the fact that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. If you go look at the conditions in the international arena in kind of the early 1920s, post-World War I, there's a lot of parallels to today in terms of great power competition is back. It's a multi-power environment, so it's kind of different from the Cold War that a lot of people potentially compare U.S. and China to as well. But now you've got multiple international actors on the stage that are all racing for different technologies, different advantages as treaties come and go. And so it also goes to show as the Navy is fighting through that and trying to figure out what it looks like, right? The service squadron, they had some idea. They knew they needed more ships, but just like today, a service force, more oilers, more tugs, more dry docks, things like that, those aren't warships that add to the battle force, and Navy leadership then as now is seemingly hesitant to procure those in any great number. Even toward the end of the interwar period and in closing in on 1940, it was still difficult to get them to buy into the fact that we needed more support ships than we had. The other interesting parallel to today is in terms of kind of the surface battle force counts today, so all of our cruisers and destroyers and things like that, we're actually right at about the same levels we were in 1920, right around 120 ships or so. And it's interesting to note that our logistics forces are probably about comparably sized too. There's only a handful of oilers and repair ships and supply ships that are out there right now, far less than probably somewhere between 10 and 20% of the current battle force count. So not a lot. As we grew into World War II, kind of 1938 and then into 1941, the service force really exploded out of sheer necessity. But thankfully by then, most of the initial strategic development done during the interwar period at least had provided the framework for it to get the Navy kind of positioned to where they wanted it to go. So they knew what they had to do. They just had a lot of trouble procuring and acquiring, getting the funding from Congress to do that, which I think is, again, relevant to today as we look at increasing fleet size and figuring out how to fight again in the Western Pacific, which is a very difficult environment for anyone to fight in, particularly if you're playing the away game, right? The Russians found that out the hard way in the Russo-Japanese War in 1905. Both the U.S. and Spanish found that hard fighting over the Philippines in the Spanish-American War. And then we certainly had our fair share of challenges in World War II as well. And now, and in that case, Japan was playing the home game. In our case, China will be playing the home game again as well, and having interior lines of communication is a huge benefit, whereas we have to bring everything with us. I mean, it's a long way from Pearl Harbor to get to the Western Pacific, and even longer to get from the West Coast of the United States.
So from a resourcing perspective, I'd like to explore, and you talked and discussed about acquisition and budget. My assumption, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the warships and the shipbuilding process takes longer and is more costly. So if I was the CNO and I had to make a resource decision, why would I not accept the risk with regards to the support ships vice the actual battleships themselves?
So ship cost is certainly an interesting thing to look at. By far and above, there's no contest that our ships today are far more complex than anything we had in World War II. That didn't mean that it didn't take a long time for World War II for the ships in World War II to be built, right? It was still, especially early on in the late 30s, actually through the interwars, we were building the treaty cruisers. It was still 2 to 3 years to deliver a treaty cruiser during the interwar period. And then as we got into the war, it only sped up because we had the industrial base to do it. So if we kind of decouple how long it takes to build a ship to how many ships we're delivering per month, right? And we see the statistics China's putting out, having commissioned an SSB and a big deck amphib and one of the new Renhais all on the same day. I mean, the sheer industrial output of them makes that possible, right? To say that you're delivering warships every single month means you just have more bases doing it. It doesn't mean they're necessarily building them faster. It just means they have more shipyards able to build them and turn them out so that they're coming out at a much more regular cadence. We don't have that today. We lack any really, all of our shipyards, both public and private, are basically at capacity with maintenance and construction right now. If we had to increase that significantly, we'd be very challenged to bring that output in any sort of rapid fashion because the nation has lost the ability to do kind of big ship construction. And it's not something that's easy to recover. Shipyards take a lot of time and capital to build. And a lot of that land, a lot of the prime land has been sold off or sold back. And there's only a few spots probably in the United States where we could rapidly reconstitute a shipyard that was previously there, whether that's in Long Island or Mare Island or even up in like Philadelphia. But even then, it's a very difficult thing to get those things up and running in any time soon. If we wanted ships by the end of the decade, we'd probably have to start reconstituting those yards now before they'd start producing their first ships, because it would take that long to get equipment, people, everyone up to speed, the yard certified to start actually producing an output. And we just don't have that today. We didn't have it in the 1920s either. And that presence slowly scaled as we started building more ships. And then once the Two Ocean Navy Act, or the Vincent Trammell Act of 1938, that built the fleet that won the war, when that came online is when you saw more shipyards starting to kind of shift over production, because the production model there was also different in terms of in the interwar period and even through the end of World War II, till Arleigh Burke disestablished the General Board. The Navy had complete control over its own designs, right? Production was contracted out, whereas today we contract with contractors for design, development, and construction and delivery and sustainment, whereas back then the Navy could just contract out the same design to multiple yards for construction instead of having to worry about, well, Lockheed has this design, they need to do it in their yards, and General Dynamics has this design, they have to do it in their yards, and we don't have the data rights to take, say, the design of a littoral combat ship or a DDG and just compete that against anyone who wants to go build it. We have some data, but we don't have enough data to go off and do production level builds like that. And that's another expensive piece of thing that we have to go tackle if we had to spin production back up to that level.
Thanks for that. That was very insightful. And I imagine we could take another whole series of articles and podcasts to explore that topic alone with regards to acquisition. I'd like to circle back to the title of your article, and not intending to spoil it for the listener who's not read the article, but can you describe how Service Support Squadron actually became or was the Great Western Base as part of your title? And can you expand on the concept and maybe tease out some historical operational examples?
Absolutely. So after the end of World War One, and kind of really kind of the early aughts after the 1900s and then 1910s and after World War One especially, all of the naval planners shifted and pivoted immediately to the Western Pacific, right? The development of the rainbow plans. So in the case of the Pacific Against Japan, War Plan Orange, right? There were other colors for other adversaries, right? Great Britain, Germany, Russia, all of them all had there. But War Plan Orange was what eventually became the strategy we executed in World War II. But early on, it was almost dogmatic within the naval strategy circles that the U.S. Navy needed their equivalent of Gibraltar in the Western Pacific. They needed a forward operating base to establish in peacetime, whether that was in Subic Bay in the Philippines, or whether that was Guam or something else, that in order for us to win the war, it was flatly accepted that we had to have a base there to provide support services. But as everything developed on the wargaming floors in the Naval War College, right, as they were gaming through all these different scenarios, they were gaming through everything, time and time again, the Navy would lose, right? The bases wouldn't be there. They'd come under direct attack, and they would come under, and they would be unsustainable. And then the strategists would pivot and try and say, hey, within the first week of hostilities or something like that, the Navy has to launch itself forward and establish kind of a forward austere operating base and improvise and do that, but not only take it, but hold it. And that, again, on the wargaming floors, as they went through the cycle of research and tried all these different things, that never bore out. It was never sustainable. It was never doable for them to do it. And so over the course of the interwar period, by the time you get to the late 1930s, it's abundantly clear to naval strategists that the accepted dogma that we have to have a Great Western fixed base is gone, to the point where they've realized now the only way to fight and win in the Western Pacific is through mobile basing. And they realize that's what it's going to take. They start looking at how to adapt the fleet and what's needed to go do that. And the war games start faring a lot better. And I would say the paradigm shift was so complete that early on in World War II, I think pre-Pearl Harbor in 1941, when the British were tending to their empire and trying to sort things out and wanting to not pay attention to what was going on in the Pacific, because obviously they had their hands full in Europe, they even offered the United States the what was widely considered the finest naval base in the Western Pacific. They offered us Singapore. The transition was so complete. The shift was so complete in how naval strategists thought that they didn't even bat an eye and they rejected it, because there was no need for a Western base, and the fleet had already been designed and reorganized to fight completely at sea. And what really reinforce this is, and I talked a little bit about the cycle of research. I'll expand on that quickly because I think it's important. And we're starting to see the first elements of that truly coming back today. But back then, officers made multiple tours through the Naval War College. It wasn't just to go get a graduate degree like we do today. It was there doing deep study in tactics, in doctrine, in doctrinal development, and in wargaming. And so they would go there to do nothing but wargame for a year or be a tactics instructor there for a year while writing everything else out. A lot of what happened with the development of naval aviation was a testament to what then Commander Reeves did at the Naval War College as a tactics instructor, working out what bombing would look like on paper before he was able to go back and figure out how to actually make that work in the mid 1920s when he finally got command of aviation squadrons on the West Coast to go figure out how that worked. Like, that all happened at the Naval War College. As new doctrinal ideas tested themselves well on the War College, those got folded into our fleet battle problems. So every single year, sometimes multiple times a year, the Chief of Naval Operations, or the Commander-in-Chief of Atlantic Fleet at the time, because we didn't have a CNO yet, would run these massive battle problems intending to pit blue forces and black forces against each other, and they would be trying all these new things out. It's the same spot that early on, those fleet battle problems drove the need for a cruiser, which didn't exist in inventory at the time. We needed something with longer range and more heavy armor that wasn't a dreadnought. I mean, it's what drove the development of fast carrier warfare tactics, right? The carrier strike group just did not come fully formed out of doctrinal development. It was about 15 years to start figuring out how do you increase launch and recovery rates? How do you do all this other stuff? And so they were doing that in the floating laboratory of these fleet battle problems. And then to close the cycle of research, they brought it back at the end of them, and it was these ruthless, ruthless murder boards. But everyone came into them with a really kind of learning mindset and open to it to critique and figure out what didn't work, what did work, what worked well, and that would be reincorporated in the draft doctrine for next year that everyone fought by. So you've got this great pipeline both at sea and in the floating experimentation there being driven by insights on the wargaming floors at the War College, driving doctrinal development, and that's how they, in the case of Service Squadron 10 and in the Great Western Base, is how they eventually get to the idea of what mobile basing needs to look like, to the point that once the war starts, they knew they needed forward staging bases somewhere. And to kind of come back to the cycle of research quickly, right, Nimitz looked at the war, and after the war said that nothing really surprised him during the war. Everything that happened, he had already seen in multiple different flavors on the wargaming floors at the War College. The only thing that was kind of truly out of left field, truly a surprise, was the kamikaze tactics at the end. That was not something they had anticipated. But the general course of the war, how it would flow, what the likely Japanese moves or the possible Japanese moves and counter moves would be, they were all basically foretold, and it was just a matter of Nimitz to try and figure out how to shepherd his resources in the Pacific to get there. And so when the Japanese opened up the campaign in the Solomons, it became very quickly to see that they needed to seize and establish a forward base at Espiritu Santo. And then as the war progressed and we came to the Solomons and started the drive across the Central Pacific, that's when Service Squadron 10 was actually formed and then started its move in November of 1943 at Funafuti. And then the rest there is history as they move forward and the Service Squadron just built in size and numbers and capability.
So you discussed this cycle of research and the process of experimentation and then the subsequent paradigm shift towards the acceptance of this afloat Western base. We've obviously lost some of that. Why do you think we've lost that, and what is going to be the catalyst to push us back in that direction?
So I would say we lost it for a while, but we picked it back. We're starting to pick it back up. Admiral Swift, when he was, either U.S. Pacific Fleet Commander or Surface Fleet Commander, somewhere out there back when he was there, he started reviving fleet battle problems just in the Pacific at his level. They weren't fully coordinated through the War College and everything else, at least to my knowledge. I don't know. I'm not sure. He started doing some of those, and then now you're starting to see them happen in greater detail. In fact, in the last week or two, the Navy's been going through its first fleet unmanned battle problem to start better integrating unmanned systems teaming with our current ships and for some doctrinal development. I would say we lost a lot of it after the end of the Cold War, right? The Navy's purpose, our fundamental identity, evaporated overnight with the fall of the Soviet Union. As fleet battle problems went away after World War II, not much happened. But as the Cold War started really heating up at sea, and I've written about this before too, right? The cycle of experimentation was played out through the Chief of Naval Operations Strategic Studies Group in the early 1980s when that first came about. And Admiral Hayward at the War College at the time was, there's a great piece from Admiral Hayward in SimSec this week as well. I think it came out yesterday on April 30th. There was a great cycle of development happening there. They brought the wargaming piece back. They worked on, to develop those kind of novel and fundamental tactics, which then in turn were tried at sea with our actual battle fleet. So it didn't necessarily go straight into another fleet battle problem, but it actually was used against our adversaries in real time. They conducted kind of small deployments, and they conducted large-scale exercises off the coast of Norway using the Soviets as the adversary, because the Soviets had to respond. You're seeing the same tit-for-tat happen around Taiwan right now, and Russia's testing us. They're doing the same thing. We're actually playing against our actual adversaries and not having a Red Force simulate what the People's Liberation Army Navy or the Russian Navy would do in there, because they're forced to respond because tensions are high enough right now. So that worked well throughout the 1980s. It's how we developed the 1980s maritime strategy that proved so successful for the Navy. But at the end of the Cold War, when the Soviet Union collapsed and Russia emerged, and in the period of peacetime, the peace dividends, all of that went away. There was simply no need for it because we were in an era of perpetual peace, right? Francis Fukuyama said we were at the end of history and that war would be gone. There was no need to. So the Navy divested itself in a large degree to not do doctrinal development anymore and not do it because we didn't really see that we had a peer competitor that we had to go fight. As soon as we got into the early 2000s with Operation Enduring Freedom and an Operation Iraqi Freedom, right? When we sent sailors ashore to support ground forces ashore, there was still no peer competitor for the Navy to have to train and fight against at sea. Sure, the Russians and the Chinese were there, but they still weren't the growing power they were. But now as we get into formally codified in 2018 with the National Defense Strategy, right, we're back in great power competition. The Navy now has peer competitors it needs to train to fight against and be ready to potentially go to war against if so ordered. And that's a challenge. And so to figure out how we fight, right? I mean, after the end of the Taiwan Straits crisis in 1996, China has spent the last 25 years perfecting its concept of operations to defeat both the Aegis combat system and what that power that brings and U.S. carrier warfare, right? We haven't changed the centerpiece of our kind of core doctrinal approach to how we fight. And now China has spent its entire time building up concepts of operations to pick that apart in spades. And you're seeing that in the development of the DF-21 and DF-26, how the bombers are making their runs, how they're pushing missiles further and further out to the point where you see pieces emerging regularly now in proceedings, War on the Rock, SimSex, and other outlets talking about the fact that we're completely outranged now and that the combat radius of F-35s and everything else like that just cannot match up to the missiles the Chinese have deployed, right? And that's by design. And so getting back into the cycle of research now is what's giving us the ability to start think about how do we use our platforms differently? How do we fight differently? What do we actually need to go forward and do? I would say we're probably still a little early on in that cycle for those to truly inform what we need from a support squadron perspective or from even just additional platforms and capabilities, right? Right now we're learning to figure out what we don't know fully or what we need and what will and will not work. Right, which traditionally had just been relegated to our research labs, but potentially not fully coupled with actual operational forces to figure out all the nitty-gritty things like logistics. So we're getting back into it now. It's probably a little too soon to tell how effective it'll be or if it'll be effective. I'm sure we're learning, but it's hard to predict where it's going to go in the future.
I'd like to circle back one last time to the actual Service Squadron 10. The sheer size of the squadron that you identified shocked me. Can you share with the listeners some of the numbers and how they compare to today?
Yes. So early on service, I mean, early on the first service squadrons when they stood up, originally a Service Squadron 4 was a handful of ships. I mean, you could count them on one hand, the first forces assigned to it, but it grew pretty rapidly to the point at the end of World War II, service squadrons had grown from a couple of ships to, by July 1945, the service force. So all of the service squadrons plus the service force for supporting 7th Fleet totaled nearly 3,000 ships and 500,000 sailors. 500,000 sailors by sheer size is more than the entire active duty Navy today by more than 100,000 sailors. And 3,000 ships, we don't even come close to that. I mean, our entire battle force count is somewhere in the low 300s right now, and our support ships going in there are probably still under 100, comfortably under 100, I'm sure. I'd have to go look that up, but So we're starting fairly similar to what we did in 1938, 1940 timeframe. And that's why I think the parallels are wonderful to look at, because we're facing a lot of the same problems in terms of the percentages of forces allocated to the actual battle force versus servicing the battle fleet.
And that's a great transition. So transitioning to current capabilities, one of your quotes in the article that struck me was, quote, "With most maintenance done ashore in contracted facilities, sailors have lost the ability to conduct deep maintenance and repair that their predecessors did as a matter of course." That's a pretty damning statement. Can you frame out what the current problem is and the implications to both the modern Navy and the Marine Corps?
It sounds bad, but at the same time, I look at this from the perspective of no one in the Navy has gone into this trying to hamstring our sailors or do anything else, right? At the end of the Cold War, right, as the peace dividend took hold, there was a big kind of fundamental shift in how the military bought and sustained its weapon systems, right? We had the widespread belief that contractors could do it cheaper than government. And so that's what we pivoted towards, right? All the maintenance and the design all went out of government and went back into the private, or went into the private sector, because we thought it was going to be cheaper to do so. I mean, our ability to control that and control cost is directly related to how much of that technical data that I talked about earlier that we actually buy, right? So everyone, there's a lot of folks who out there, as I talk with different people, are like, well, we have plenty of data. We're getting data in the contracts. And it's like, nah, not quite to the degree you need, right? Most of the data, and any sailors out there who have done maintenance and had frustrations with their systems and in seeing that, are seeing the living results of this, right? As we go out there and we conduct troubleshooting, and then you step in through the electronic tech manual, and it gets you to this go see secondary block diagram. And that's not, we didn't procure that, and it was a cost saving measure. And that's a relegated to contractor level maintenance, whether from someone supporting at the naval base from the contractor, or it needs to actually be a depot level repair from the contractor facility and have them send a flyaway team to help it, because that's how they structured the data rights and the repair capabilities, or the specific tool sets and knowledge and whatnot were not something the Navy was willing to invest in to go do that. And it was better to have it at the contractor's production facilities, where all the equipment already existed to produce it anyway. And so we don't have the technical data we need to actually go do that deep maintenance, right? We have enough technical data to do the maintenance we assign to the operators and to conduct kind of basic systems engineering activities like configuration management and things like that. But we're not buying every single technical drawing. We're not buying the layers upon layers upon layers of everything. We're largely not buying that stuff just out of sheer cost, right? From a business perspective, right, that's the other side that makes this incredibly complex, is because it's the private sector, there's an incentive there that they're in business to make money, right? And that technical data is what makes them their money, right? It makes them needed. It's the same model that essentially we're seeing in industry right now, with paying for subscriptions for everything and having that kind of steady recurring income, right? That's, if we were to go off and buy that technical data rights, you're looking at like Lockheed Martin or General Dynamics or any of the other contractors out there looking at saying, what if we had to sell this off, what's the life of the platform supposed to be? How much maintenance did we expect to do on every platform each year? And they're costing out what that lost income is that the Navy would have paid them to do that maintenance. And then adding on top of that, a fair profit margin, right? That adds up into the hundreds of millions, if not billions, or maybe even trillion, if we talk about F-35. In dollars. And so it's very, very hard for the Navy to stomach those kinds of costs. And so it's really difficult to break away from that. And so it's a thorny, complex problem. I don't have a good solution for that, because it's really wicked. It's in the classic sense of the wicked term. It's a wicked problem. But at the same time, our sailors, we don't have the necessary repair parts and tools as a result on board the ship, so that when something fails, it's very, very difficult for them to not just look at it and say, well, the last guidance I have is to replace this circuit card as the lowest replaceable unit and send the circuit card back to the contractor for repair. Unfortunately, I think it would take war probably to shift that mindset, right? As sailors are trying to limp out of the battle zones and get their ships back up. I mean, you look at the complexities of the Aegis combat system, or even the other surface combat systems, radars, the control systems for turbine generators and everything else. They're all very complex, very electrical, and battle damage is going to make it incredibly hard to get those systems back online with the tight tolerances and clearances that they require to actually get power back. I mean, you look at what happened with USS Cole in 2000, right? The explosives alongside there were equivalent to a heavyweight torpedo detonating against the side of the ship. they experienced a catastrophic power loss, and they were struggling. They could not get a single turbine generator back online. Finally, a lone sailor on his own initiative managed to get one of the diesel generators up and running and got it connected to the switchboards. But that was out of sheer know-how and the ability to bypass it. It was still a long time before they were able even to get enough power to start thinking about how to restore systems before they were able to even get some semblance of a propulsion back online or bring the combat system back online or a radar back online. And Cole was sitting in a harbor. It was shallow water, right? There wasn't as much of a threat there, but the crew was exhausted. Now think about fighting through that same scenario in the Western Pacific where you're literally trying to fight your ship from sinking, as the opening in my essay talks about with the USS Houston, right? You're fighting left and right to keep the dewatering going and keeping the water out of the ship to try and keep it afloat as you're trying to restore propulsion and get out of the area before they come back to finish the job or to see if they sunk you in the first place. And so in the case of USS Houston, they're trying to eke its way out of there, right? That's a long trip from the Western Pacific to even get to Ulithi was 1,200 miles as the furthest forward like operating base that we had at the time. And that took another cruiser and two fleet tugs to try and limp her along. And it was touch or go there for a long time. And we'd see something similar happen with our DDGs now. I mean, you look at the Fitzgerald and the McCain collisions, they saw some similar things and they got some immediate support. And Fitzgerald wasn't quite as bad. They were able to limp back. McCain certainly had their own problems and after the collision there, but those were just collisions. Take in actual explosive effects and battle damage, and it gets far, far worse. And now you're in the East China Sea, South China Sea, right? Sea of Japan, somewhere in there. You're a long way from home, a long way from protection to even do that. In today's model, I mean, a conflict in the Western Pacific, right? We have to assume that places like Japan are going to be off the table. Guam is going to be off the table, if not a sinking hole, to begin with at the outset of hostilities. So the friendliest forces from the United States, the friendliest base where they'd have capabilities would either be Australia or Hawaii, which are 2,000 miles away. And everyone thinks about, oh, we can get back there. It's like the cold, hard reality of the math even says that at 5 knots, it takes you a week to go 1,000 miles. Right? At 14 knots, an economical cruising speed for a destroyer or something like that with the gas turbines, right? Going 2,000 miles takes you a week. With any battle damage, if you've got metal hanging off the side, right, you're reduced to slow speeds, and it's at 5 knots, and you're trying to struggle to maintain control. Getting 2,000, 2,500 miles by yourself all the way back to Pearl Harbor without enough support, that's a 2 to 3 week journey at minimum, to say nothing about additional problems or where you're going, and that's 2 to 3 weeks of a crew having to try and fight its way through. I mean, that's one thing that I think all of our recent examples, whether it's Stark, Sammy B, Cole, Fitzgerald, McCain, have all proved that, like, damage control is hard. It's exhausting for the crew. It's exhausting for the sailors. It's hard to keep up that battle rhythm because it's not just I fix the thing and it stays fixed. It's you have to continually improve shoring, continually dewater, continually try and get things back. I mean, as we look at trying to get the ship in a stable condition again from a damage control perspective, that loss of the data, the loss of the repair parts and the knowledge in the sailors, as a result of that kind of slow glacial shift toward contractor-led maintenance, it could really come back to hurt us as we think about a future fight and getting our ships at least out of the danger zone and back there.
I appreciate that detailed response, and I would certainly agree that the problem that you've identified and laid out for us is a wicked problem. I'll tell you, one of the things I admired about your article, though, was that you also proposed some solutions. Oftentimes, authors will simply admire the problem or talk about the problem, but you came out in the conclusion of your article and you proposed some concrete proposals or opportunities for us to get after this. Can you describe some of those solutions or opportunities?
The biggest and the first and biggest one, right, as I said before, the Chinese have had 25 years to develop a concept of operations that is tailor-made to pick apart the carrier strike group and our ability to conduct warfare with carriers in the Aegis combat system, right? That we haven't changed that. The easiest way, the most cost-effective way to completely turn that problem on its head very, very rapidly is to simply change our concept of operations that renders their con ops now largely irrelevant, or they have to now go figure out how to turn it back to something that they can make work, right? So the first proposal I make is everything they've done is tailor-made to operate against our carrier strike groups. We'll take the carrier out of the picture, right? We know missiles are going to be the ones that need to fight. So let's go take and leave the destroyers and the cruisers to go forward, and the other, and especially working with the Marines now as they look toward littoral operations in a contested environment and expeditionary advanced base operations, right? They're looking to do much more kind of joint hybrid type looking warfare, right? The Army and the Air Force are looking to get in on that as well, right? Simply pulling the aircraft carriers out of there and sending them and relegating them to logistics role would be a perfect first start. Because I think that there's a great opportunity there to kind of form the core of the service squadrons around the aircraft carriers and some of the other what I'll call ugly ducklings of the fleet, the expeditionary staging bases, the staging docks, the catamaran hull, expeditionary fast transports, all of that, right? If they're well outside the combat zone, the carrier has the ability to supply local sea control to ensure that we protect those units, right? I mean, I think the Chinese have learned the Japanese experience very, very well, and I don't think our supply lines would go uninterdicted like they did in World War II. They'd be the first thing taken out this time. But putting the carrier back there and some of the other combatants back there to help with that, I think, lets us protect our actual service force in a far better fashion. It makes them mobile again. The nuclear power provides the ability to continually steam and do a lot of that other stuff. It provides a floating flight deck, which was the big constraint we had in World War II. All the places they looked at storing where Service Squadron 10 anchored at, the only land-based requirement they had was an airstrip, right? They needed to be able to, I mean, sure, we had aircraft carriers, but they needed to be able to fly in the big planes, right? They needed to be able to fly in the B-17s. They needed to be able to fly in all the other transports to get supplies from the mainland here. They couldn't get that on small aircraft that were confined to landing on aircraft carriers, right? I think the larger aircraft carriers we have now allow for some of that, right? The C-3 platform, and now slowly being replaced by the V-22, the Osprey, have a decent cargo capacity, and they have a decent range. I mean, the MV-22 in the naval variant, the one-way range is closing in on 1,000 miles. That is tactically significant as we want to move supplies back and forth and have the ability to do that. I think unmanned systems play a huge role in that as well in terms of ferrying supplies to and from. That was one of the things that Service Squadron 10 during the war did in spades, right? Instead of having to figure out how do I get specific supplies and requests for individual units of the combat force forward.
So Ryan, you identify that the aircraft carrier is an opportunity potentially to serve as the kind of the nucleus of a new service support squadron. And I would love to see that exercise in the actual fleet battle problem. Additionally, earlier in the conversation, you discussed the new unmanned fleet battle problem. Can you discuss that a little bit more, maybe some opportunities from a logistics perspective?
Sure. I wish I had more up-to-date information on what happened in the fleet unmanned battle problem other than what's been kind of published in the news. I mean, I was overjoyed to see this past week when they announced that the destroyer John Finn had successfully intercepted a target using a sensor track from an unmanned platform, right? So they conducted an engagement at 250 nautical miles with a standard missile with over-the-horizon targeting provided by an unmanned system, right? One of the biggest, most fundamental things that the Navy needs to do to fight and survive in the Western Pacific is decouple sensors from shooters, right? Which means unmanned systems especially need to form a very integral part of that sensor network, of that kill web, right? Because anything that's radiating in the Western Pacific is going to be the target, right? You light off Aegis, you're immediately a target. You light off any other radar, you're probably immediately a target, right? Space-based connections make it very easy to do that. So the big deal there is we have to have many more unmanned systems providing that. Shepherding those unmanned systems is difficult, right? They still have logistical and maintenance requirements just like anyone else, right? None of them are powered by a perpetual motion machine, which means they need periodic maintenance. They need more fuel oil. They need more lubricating systems. They need more preventative maintenance done. All of that still needs to happen, right? Things are still going to break. I think the kind of anchoring a nucleus of a service squadron on an aircraft carrier and some of those other kind of modern misfits, right, the expeditionary fast transports and the staging bases provide the perfect opportunity to exercise something like that. I'm also excited to see the light amphibious warship come on. I think that could be a very powerful piece in this as well from a logistics standpoint to shuttle small things to and fro. I also think that the Navy would do well to buy the new national national security multi-mission vessel or the training ship that we use at our merchant marine academies, right? Relatively small, has capacity for 1,000 people, has a flight deck, has a bunch of open space on it, right? I think they're a good size to provide kind of distributed logistics and distributed repair functions, whether that's logistics and repair for unmanned systems or it's logistics for marine detachments ashore conducting expeditionary advanced base operations, right? The smaller the platform going forward away from that hub, the less of a target it presents just in terms of cost, right? The aircraft carrier is a high-value unit. There's a lot of national capital and prestige in them, right? Keeping that out of the battle space and allowing smaller and smaller increments of logistics go forward makes it a harder and harder calculus for our adversaries to adapt to, right? It's no longer as worth it to launch. Would they really want to launch a DF-26 to take out a single expeditionary fast transport, right? A single catamaran hull that's carrying up to 600 tons of payload, right? It doesn't seem that way. And so I think you could either make logistics unmanned or you could use some manned ships, whether that's marine manned and taking those in, or that's sailor manned or a hybrid crew of some sort, taking any number of smaller vessels forward or even shepherding and controlling fleets of unmanned systems. There's been a lot of speculation out there, both in the fictional stuff that SimSec has posted recently, or at least earlier this year when they had the fiction contest. There were a lot of great ideas in there coming out about how to use either a manned warship or other manned platform to kind of be the mother hen for a number of unmanned platforms and what those look like, right? A lot of the unmanned systems we have in there now are smaller. They're not going to have the same amount of legs that a destroyer does. They're not that big. And so they're going to need more close shepherding and C2 capabilities. And the more we can distribute some of that across the fleet and give our ability to have control it almost in a fractal level, in the sense that I can create self-similarity at lower and lower levels to allow for a large scale of the force to go forward with a large scale logistics element and slowly decompose that into something smaller and smaller, and give that over to the unmanned system so that they can figure out how to get those supplies forward almost into a trickle to where they need to go, I think would be a powerful way to continue to remain flexible in the Western Pacific and move our forces around and get things in and out. So I think there's a great opportunity for unmanned there, and it'd be really interesting to experiment in there. I think the other thing that the experimenting needs to start taking a hold of is, even as of recent, all of our fleet battle problems are still only, you know, a week long. They're in local waters or relatively local waters off the coast of Hawaii or off the coast of California or something like that. We're experimenting there, but one of the things that I think all the wargaming at the War College in the interwar period proved out in spades is we're not looking sufficiently at campaign length issues, right, which force logistics to the forefront, right? Anyone can go out there for a week and sustain, right? The food loadouts and the supply loadouts all the ships have make it a non-issue, right? But if you're forced to go do the exercise, say in the Solomons, right, go fight a month-long fleet battle problem in the Solomons, now you actually need to start figuring out logistics and getting things to and fro and figuring out how to actually make that work. It's all the little intricacies of things like that that are needed to really take any doctrinal concepts and really flesh them out. That's coming back to what Reeves did with naval aviation, right? That's one of the big things is everyone could say, well, we could come up with that tactics, right? But in the 1920s, 1925, 26, it would never have worked, right? Langley could only spot a couple of aircraft on deck at any given time. Their sortie generation rate was extremely low. So even if someone had thought of it, there was just simply no way for the ship itself that had to go do it to do it. And I think we have to go do the same thing with unmanned systems as well. It's not just one thing to go game and come up with it or play with concepts over a week's time, right? It's going to take a long period of experimentation and dedicated time to figure out what does this need to look like? What are the little things out there that we need to go learn that aren't necessarily directly and explicitly a part of the doctrine or the concept of operations, but are kind of those derived requirements, I'll say, those things that we just have to be able to go do, right? You can't do fast carrier warfare unless you can produce sortie generation rates of X. We take that for granted now, but in the 20s, it was almost sacrilegious for them to say we can get more. It was very, very difficult. It was only through almost an iron fist of Reeves to try and force them to learn and to think about it and to challenge his crews to improve. Same thing with bombing accuracy, same thing with gunnery accuracy. We had to do all of those things and figure out a way to improve that when a lot of people were saying it can't be done. But I think using some of that experimentation now with unmanned systems will help us identify all those little things that no one's thinking of yet that are producing huge challenges, or that will produce huge challenges for shepherding unmanned systems and figuring out, hey, can we even do this? So I think that there's a good opportunity there for unmanned shepherding and kind of unmanned basing and allowing, especially as the Marines are also looking to experiment, to use the service squadron type concept as the way to form kind of the core doctrinal elements to do that, and then say, how might I use this for supporting Marines doing expeditionary advanced base operations, or how do I support destroyers and littoral combat ships doing, and eventually the new frigates, in doing distributed maritime operations? How do I integrate with the joint force, right? You can now have different elements doing that and learning all those lessons.
No, and I would retort with, I think, you know, from the expeditionary advanced base operations perspective, how those operations can facilitate and support the actual service squadrons of the future, I think, is something I would like to explore as well. You've provided listeners with a number of different solutions and opportunities as we start looking towards the future. If you were the CNO right now, what immediate changes would you implement and why?
Knowing how wicked the problem is, right? If there were easy solutions, we would have already done them, or found a way to do them, or Congress would mandate it, or something would happen to make it a lot easier. Given the wickedness and the complexity of this overall problem, it's extremely difficult to do that. I think the first thing to do is we need to go learn what we don't know. If I could pick one thing that I would go do right now, it would be to do a lot of what we were just talking about. How do you get that campaign length information? How do you really push the system? How do you really experiment with it? And it'd be a hard sell to go tell the Secretary of Defense and the President, I'm pulling one of the carriers offline to go experiment. Right. That's a very difficult thing to do right now, given what's happening in the world and our over-reliance on presence operations and in carrier strike power in certain different areas of the world. But to be able to pull that one offline and say, no, I need to go experiment for 3 to 6 months with this doing campaign level stuff, because we need to go learn what we don't know yet and see what can work and what can change things. I think that's probably the first thing I would do. Because from that, we can start figuring out how we prioritize resourcing and figure out what we still need and how to adapt things and what changes need to be made, right? We're not going to know until we start experimenting in a big, robust fashion like that.
Yeah, that's a very poignant comment. And I think you alluded to it in your previous comment, but oftentimes we treat exercises and experimentations, the logistical aspects of those, as purely administrative. And as soon as we start operationalizing some of those logistics requirements in support of exercising experimentation, particularly from a campaigning perspective, I think those will be the opportunities to start identifying those future challenges. Finally, as guests come to the program with different views and backgrounds, I ask you to help me expand my own perspective as I wrestle with my own definition. But how do you define maritime security?
That's a good question. I think it's one of those definitions that eludes an easy answer. In my own personal opinion, I think maritime security is, I wouldn't go as far to say as to ensure the free flow of goods and commerce across the maritime domain, because I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think it's ensuring the resiliency of the flow of goods, services, and information across the maritime domain, right? It will never be perfect. We're never going to have perfect supply chains. I mean, even just something as simple as the Ever Given blocking Suez showed just how brittle current and modern supply chains are. And I think from a security perspective, we're looking for much the same thing. As what security means, that we have some level of resilience, right? We have some level of ability to ensure that we can still find a way to move goods and services around, still get information around, still make things work. Even if it's not ideal, we can still find a way to move things around the world and to trade and to do everything else, right? I think that's what security winds up being. It's in a lot of ways, I think it's analogous to cybersecurity, where it's an incredibly dynamic environment. The adversary always gets a vote. There is no perfect, or if you have perfect, it's overly expensive and you'll never be able to afford it. So how do you shift the perspective from security to maritime resilience in getting to the point where we can defend sufficiently in a localized and in a temporal fashion to ensure that something can go forward to get goods and services, or force an adversary out who is denying goods and services, things like that. That's probably as close as I could come to a definition of, if that's even acceptable as a rambling answer.
No, absolutely acceptable, and I appreciate that. Ryan, my sincere appreciation for coming on the podcast today to discuss your article. To the listeners, highly recommend that you check out his article, as it offers I think both a historical background as well as future-facing opportunities for us with regards to how we can sustain the future naval force, an area that I think remains very underexplored and something that requires future experimentation. Thank you for listening, and until next time, Guten Tag.